Welcome to the Mentoris Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorisproject.org. Our guest today is Kingsley Day, the author of a novel based on the life of Guido d'Arezzo, a Benedictine monk who is regarded as the inventor, or by some the developer, of the modern staff notation in music, though his birth date, somewhere around 990 CE, and his birthplace, possibly Tuscany, possibly Ferrara, they're all up for question. So it will be great to hear what Kingsley learned from his own research. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I always start with asking, why do you think that Guido's work is important to us today?
Well, it's important because it's still used. It's still the standard way that musical pitch is notated. So you go to an orchestra concert, they're all playing off lined music staffs with pitches notated on the lines and spaces, just the way he invented it. Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, none of that would have been written down if he hadn't, or he or someone else hadn't come up with a way of notating pitch. And even today, when recording technology makes it possible for people to write songs without knowing how to read or write music, nevertheless, if someone has a hit song that they create in the recording studio and it's a hit, then it gets published, and it can only get published if somebody else comes in and notates it on a staff. So music notation, here we are 1,000 years after he invented this, and yet it's still the same basic system of notating pitch. A fifth staff line was added about 200 years after Guido. He just used four lines, but it's still the same basic idea of lines and spaces.
So in essence, you're telling us that he came up with a language to put music on paper.
Right, right. Not rhythm. I mean, he didn't do anything about notating rhythm. But as far as pitch, which up till then could not be notated precisely, he came up with a solution.
That's so fascinating. I love when people do unique things out of the box and suddenly we're all using it.
Yes. But of course, in his case, it wasn't so easy because he encountered a great deal of opposition initially to his ideas.
For what reason? Why didn't people want such a simple thing created?
Well, he was in a monastery and they had all these chant books that they had been using, you know, laboriously hand copied chant books in which the chants were notated with just little dots going, maybe a higher dot for a higher pitch and a lower dot for a lower pitch, but, you know, nothing precise. But they had been using those for centuries and they took a lot of effort to make because of copying by hand. And so he was really threatening the status quo. He was saying all of this is worthless. It all needs to be redone. And so the head of the monastery where he was a monk was not at all appreciative of what he was doing. And that's why he ended up leaving the monastery and going to Arezzo, where he became the chorus master at the cathedral.
That's so interesting. So somebody would be against the idea because it changed what they were used to.
Yeah.
Pretty typical. Well, I understand, of course, that as we're saying, his early details are difficult to find. So I wonder what you did discover about possibly his childhood and how that might have influenced his interest in both being a monk and in music.
I didn't really discover anything about his childhood. I mean, the known facts about his life are so minimal. I was lucky that this project was a biographical novel and not a biography, because a straight biography of Guido would be about 3 pages long, you know, if you just stuck to the actual known facts. So I had to invent a childhood for him. I had to invent a family for him. Luckily, I think, happened upon the idea of making his father a potter. The area around Tala, which is the village that claims him as a native son, although, as you say, there's several different contenders about where he was actually born. But that region had been known since Roman times for rich clay that was used in making pottery. So that gave me the idea of making his father a potter, which then led to kind of an ongoing motif in the book, in that I had his father working on a little goblet, chalice, kind of drinking vessel when Guido was being born, when his mother was in labor, and scrawling the name Guido on this little piece of pottery. And then when Guido is baptized, the family brings that in and says, can we use this as part of the ceremony? And then when he does become a monk, it's used as part of that ceremony. And so he carries it with him throughout his life. So a little piece of his childhood stays with him.
A bit of a talisman in many ways.
Yes, yes.
Well, I love the idea that your research led you to the idea that clay was an important part of that particular part of the country at the time. That's what we do in writing, right? We have to make up things, but they have to be suitable to the where we're going with the story. Was there any information in terms of the kinds of people that he worked with or who might have influenced him or been in some way a relationship that fueled his life? Obviously, he never married if he was a monk.
The one relationship we know about is that he had a friend at the monastery in Pomposa, that's where he was a monk, named Michael, Brother Michael. And we know this because he wrote a letter, epistola, to Brother Michael. And really, most of what we know about his life is revealed in that letter. That's where he talks about how both he and Michael were persecuted at the monastery and punished at the monastery for being proponents of these ideas about music notation, and how he left the monastery. In this letter, he talks about going to see the Pope in Rome, because he was summoned by the Pope after the Pope got word of this new idea for notating music. So he talks about that, and clearly Michael was somehow, I mean, Michael was persecuted along with Guido, so had some kind of involvement in what was being done in terms of music notation. So what I made up out of that was that Michael was a fellow monk who had a lot of trouble learning the chants, which at that time you could only learn them by ear. The cantor would sing a phrase and you would repeat it. So I made out that whereas Guido was very good at this, had an excellent musical ear, that Michael had a lot of trouble, and Guido was trying to come up with a way of helping this other monk. So that's a relationship we know about for sure. We also know that when he went to the cathedral in Arezzo, the archbishop there was Theodaldus, who brought him there intentionally to use his ideas. He was obviously more open to new ideas than the abbot at Pomposa. And so it was Theodaldus who encouraged him not just to use his ideas, but to write down his ideas. And so the treatises that he wrote that have come down to us were written because Theodaldus encouraged him to do that. And the first one, the Mikrologos, was dedicated to Bishop Theodaldus. I'm sorry, I think I referred to him as an archbishop. He was a bishop, so.
Oh, you know, levels of, you know, vice president, co-president, who knows? Oh, that's so fascinating, though, the idea that he would, we know we can read a lot into the acknowledgments in a book, because they're obviously people of importance to them. So if he dedicated some of this writing to this gentleman, then clearly he was important to him. Wow. And did you ever go down the rabbit hole? Was there any more information about Theodophilus?
Well, a little bit. In his case, I think we do know the date of his death. And he even figured later on, when I get into it, it's not definite, but there's evidence that at the very end of his life, he was prior at a monastery of a different order. And early in the founding of that order, Theodaldus played a part in the founding of an earlier monastery in that order. So he kind of tied into the story that way as well. So I used whatever I could find out about him.
Well, the primary documents are the best thing for historians to use. It's just there's a lack of them in many cases.
Right, right.
This is, as you said, why it makes sense that it's a biography. And it's a fictional biography.
Right.
So one of my favorite questions in that respect is, what was your favorite scene that you wrote, that you had to create in order to give a sense of this character?
Well, I don't know if it's one that gives a sense of the character, but I would say a favorite scene I wrote, and I mentioned this chalice that his father made that was kind of a talisman. And of course, Guido had to do some major traveling, including going to Rome and then back to Arezzo and between Arezzo and Pomposa. So on one of those trips, and of course, there were no highways, there were no, you know, it was very hazardous to travel. There were robbers, thieves, you know, marauding in the countryside, which is one thing I ran across in my research. So I invented a scene in which he's making one of these travels, and he and his companion are beset by thieves. They open up his satchel, they find the chalice in there, and they say, "Hey, what's that?" And they tosses it in the air, and luckily one of the thieves, you know, bobbles it but catches it just in time before it breaks. But it turns out this other thief, and I invented back when Guido first went to the monastery as an oblate, which is like an offering of the parents to the monastery of their child.
Correct.
But there was another recent arrival there, a boy named Uberto, who was not getting the music very quickly, who was not very happy there. His parents had both died. At one point, the monastery erupts in chaos because a boy has run away, has escaped from the monastery, and it's Uberto. So in a sort of Dickensian coincidence, it turns out that one of these thieves is Uberto, because he learned how to read at the monastery, and he can read the name Guido on the chalice. And he said, "Guido," and he looks at him, and he begins to recognize someone he knew all those years earlier. And so as a result of that, the thief gives them back the chalice, lets them go on their way.
I love that. I love the idea that, again, it's using the research of what was true of the era, and you're just blending into Guido's story. Mm-hmm. That's quite fun. It makes me interested in the young man and, you know, what influence that may have been given to him. Okay, so in the course of researching, when there wasn't a lot to look for, what would you say was the most interesting thing you found out about him?
The main thing, and I've already talked about this a little, but that I didn't know was that he really had to fight to get his ideas accepted. That, you know, it's a little bit like Galileo, you know, another famous Italian a few centuries later, who really did have a better idea about many things, and the church did not accept that. I was happy to read that. sorry for Guido to have undergone that, but it made for a much more dramatic plot for the book to have him facing that kind of opposition to his ideas.
Well, all good stories need conflict.
Right.
And I love that you're comparing him to other people with quote-unquote crazy ideas, whether it's Galileo, whether it's Copernicus, that we had to deal with it through the centuries.
Another interesting thing that I, of course, didn't know was this whole visit to see the Pope, when the Pope summoned him to Rome. And this particular Pope was interesting to find out more about, too, because his family was famous for corruption. He wasn't even a priest when he was elected Pope. So I was able to, in the scene, he only gives Guido one audience, one papal audience. But it was fun writing that scene because I pictured this Pope as a rather coarse man, enjoying the trappings of power, but really not a very religious man. It was fun to write the scene where they interact. But you know, what happens, as Guido describes in his letter to Michael, was he teaches the Pope to sing using his method, and the Pope does it. It works out. The Pope actually wanted him to stay in Rome and take over training the musicians in Rome at the Vatican. But he, as he again explains in the letter to Michael, that's really where we find out most of this information. It was during the summer, and the swamps around Rome were putting forth all this nasty vapor, and it affected his health, and that's why he didn't stay.
Oh, how sad, though, because what a compliment to be asked to work for the Pope directly.
Right. I mean, yeah, there would have been no higher musical position at that point. But
that's fascinating. Instead of the king's speech, you would have had the Pope's song.
Right.
Oh, then I'm going to have to go find this letter myself and read it. It sounds fascinating. Is it something you found, I imagine, somewhere online, obviously, or did you find it in a book?
I don't think it is online. I mean, maybe I wasn't able to find it online, but there's a book that has not his first treatise, Micrologos, which had already been translated when this particular scholar decided to translate the other ones, but it has his other three treatises translated with commentary. So that was a very valuable book to that I had checked out of the library for a long time.
Oh, yes, I've done that before myself. You just recheck it every 4 weeks. But it's beautiful, again, an example of how important it is to have things written down, because that's how history passes. All right, so I like to ask authors if, in the course of creating this story, you either decided that this truly exists in his life, or you had to create a theme that you felt followed him through his life, or that you use in the book to sort of draw everything together.
Again, I kind of extrapolated this from the letter to Michael, from the way he believed strongly in his ideas and kept pursuing them despite opposition. So I made him, from his childhood, someone who, even as a kid, he says, well, why should I shut up if I know I'm right, you know? In fact, he was a child when the first millennium happened, 1000 AD. And there was a lot of worry at that time. The world is going to end. And I have him as a kid say, why do you think the world's going to end just because it's 1000 AD? His mother saying, how can you, you're being sacrilegious to talk that way. And that's when he says, well, if I'm right, why shouldn't I say so, So I do keep that as a theme through the book. In fact, I do have him go become a prior at this other monastery. And I have the reason that the abbot at the other monastery is asking him to come there is because that particular abbot is kind of a dithering, well-meaning leader, but sees both sides of everything and can never make a decision. Mm-hmm. And he's heard that Guido is rather outspoken and makes up his mind and moves forward. And so that's why he asks Guido to be the prior. So I do keep that running theme of his outspokenness and his confidence in his ideas when he knows he has a good idea.
So in a way, he, instead of living through Y2K, he lived through Y1K.
Exactly.
That's so cute. Right, interesting, such an interesting time to think about. So I like to ask people if they found in the course of their research someone they could qualify as a mentor, but you've kind of hit on that it would either be Theophilus or it would be the gentleman who hired him at the next priory. Do you think in any of his work he references that?
There's so little information about that second monastery. In fact, it's not even definitively accepted that he really went there. So I think Theodaldus, Bishop Theodaldus, was definitely his mentor, the one who allowed him to put his ideas into practice and encouraged him to write them down so that we have them still today. And it was because of Theodaldus encouraging him and even helping spread his ideas that eventually the abbot at Pomposa asked Guido to come back, realized that they had made a mistake and did ask him to come back.
So interesting. I was going to ask about that. How did, in some secluded place, a gentleman comes up with an idea. How then did it spread across the whole world?
Well, the Pope had a lot to do with that, apparently. But even in any monastery, they had the scriptorium and they copied things out. And presumably at the cathedral in Arezzo, they had people, scribes, who could do that as well. And if Theodaldus ended up having this book produced that Guido wrote, then have more copies made and then I just hypothesize people coming through from other cities. Oh, here, this is what we're using, you know, and so these things get spread around. But probably the Pope's finding out about it resulted in even more widespread dissemination of his ideas.
He's the reason they went viral.
Yes.
So interesting. I wonder, so at what point did you have a chance to look into it? What point they sort of became the way things were taught?
Again, we know that by around 1200, they start to use a fifth staff line. So obviously by that point, the four line staff was an accepted method. So yeah, I would say, you know, within the next couple centuries, it sort of set in as the way things are done.
So I'm going to have to go back and look at some music now. It's not something that I do a lot of, but I have many friends who are singers, and so they will find this something. I don't even know if they know his name, and yet he's so important in their world.
Well, it's true. I mean, I have a master's in music theory, so I studied Guido d'Arezzo. You know, I had took a class in the history of music theory. But yeah, a lot of musicians don't even know who Guido was, or they may have heard the name in a music history class, but you don't find out much about him. And of course, partly why you don't find out much about him is there's not that much to find out.
True. Now, of course, you hit on another question I always like to ask people, which is how, you know, what in your background, you gave us that moment of it, but what brought you to be someone who could be interested in studying and writing about his life?
I think that was the main reason that I did pursue music theory in grad school. And, you know, my undergrad degree is in music as well. So Ken Lezebnik was the one who approached me about this. And I would have to admit that medieval music was never a particular strength of mine or even a strong interest of mine. I'm a pianist, so, you know, you tend to focus on music that was written after the piano
was invented, right.
But it was very interesting to, I mean, I, of course, had taken courses in medieval music, and it was very interesting to find out, you know, what was being done with boys in choruses at cathedrals. How were they taught? I mean, there has been research that has nothing to do with Guido, but research about how things were done in the medieval monasteries and the cathedrals as far as training chorus singers.
So you leaned on some of that research in writing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, just research about what life was like in a medieval monastery. I mean, that was a totally foreign area for me as well.
So it's a fun fact for about life in a medieval monastery that you remembered or used in the book.
What's a fun fact? Well, I mean, it's kind of obvious when you think of the picture of a typical medieval monk. You know, they had that shaved area on the top of their head, but they were shaved on a regular basis to keep that clean and clean and open on the top of their heads. That was just a traditional part of being a monk. So, of course, I have this scene where he first gets shaved by a practiced hand, so it's not painful or anything. And in fact, I create in his family two older brothers who, of course, tease their younger brother. Isn't that what all older brothers do? And at one point, they're teasing him once they find out that he's going to go to this monastery in a few weeks and become a monk. They grab some shears and start to chop off some of his hairs to give him a head start on his tonsure. That's what it was called. And only, you know, only the intervention of their mother stops this from happening.
Oh, that sounds like a charming scene to begin with. But a way to work in the true part of the history into the fictionalized part of his life. Fascinating. Well, I would have to say that outside of, we would imagine that if we think about people he mentored, they would be other monks and eventually the very people that you mentioned earlier, Tchaikovsky, and people who use his system.
Presumably at the cathedral, at the monastery, he probably had assistants who then went on to use his ideas. I think that's, again, I don't have documentary evidence, but that stands to reason that that would have happened and that would have helped perpetuate his ideas.
Well, then, the question I always like to ask people at the very end, which doesn't require any research at all, is to ask you who your mentors have been in life.
I would say my greatest mentors were both musical and both from my high school years, actually. One was the choral director at my high school, who also directed all the musicals. And so my whole career in music theater really dates back to his encouragement. And then the piano teacher that I studied with in high school, who also took it upon herself not just to give me piano lessons, but to start teaching me music theory. So that was, in a way, the germ of the Guido research. So both of them were really very influential in my pursuing music, and I kept in touch with both of them, you know, the rest of their lives. So
matches so well, because of course, in many ways, being a monk, he was a teacher, and teachers are some of the greatest mentors in our societies.
Right. And of course, he specifically was a teacher when he went to the cathedral. That was what he was hired for, really, was to teach the young boys, and then as they grew older, teach them all to sing and then direct the music at the cathedral.
It'd be lovely if we had recordings from back in the day, wouldn't it be?
True, although, I mean, Gregorian chant, which is what they did, I mean, that tradition has, you know, even now, you know, Gregorian chant was eventually written down. And I mean, when you can look up manuscripts of Gregorian chant, and it's Guido's notation. It's four lines with the little dots on the staff, no rhythmic notation at all. And you can still hear the chant, probably sung very similarly to how it was done back then.
That's an excellent suggestion for people to go off as they're reading the book, that they should listen to some chanting and get a sense of that period.
And I did a lot of research actually into, because I'm definitely no expert on Gregorian chant, or, you know, I was familiar with some of the famous chant melodies, but I researched specific chants because a lot of them, you know, I didn't want to just have things randomly happening without any specifics. So they're learning this particular chant, Gloria Lause Honor, you know, that's sung on Palm Sunday or whatever. So quite a few chants are mentioned specifically. And in fact, one ends up having a special significance for Guido and Michael, because it's the first chant that Guido notated for Michael to learn. And so in his letter, they clearly talk about how difficult it's been for them, because they were friends at the monastery, to have been separated as friends all these years. And so I use that chant that he first taught Michael as a way of communicating from Guido to Michael at one point.
Using music as a form of communication. That's beautiful. Well, this has been a lovely chat. I'm so happy that you had the time. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I appreciate all your very interesting questions, and made me think about the book in a new way, too.
That's what we're hoping for. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.